Welcome to the Be Moved and Bloom podcast. If you're ready to dive deep, find incredible inspiration, and let yourself bloom into who you're truly meant to be, you're in the right place. Here you'll find transformational stories, spiritual tools, and practical wisdom to help you be your best self. Get ready to be moved and bloom. Hello, my darling loves. Welcome back to the Be Moved and Bloom podcast. I'm your host, Louise Holcomb. And today I am literally so excited to share an incredible guest with you all, Mirabel de Cunha. So Mirabel is a Shivananda yoga teacher and so much more, but I've been following her work for a long time through Instagram and through her platforms, and I am just in love with everything she teaches, and so I wanted to have her on and share her glorious wisdom with you all. So a little bit more about Mirabel is, first of all, she instantly transmits the energy of breath as a delicious, intimate practice. She facilitated the world's first Pranayama Breathing Summit earlier this year, which featured 24 of the world's most adept wisdom keepers and scientists. It was endorsed by the Chopra Foundation and it was attended by thousands. It's an incredible online summit. Guys, check it out if you can. Mirabel has been a yoga lover, studying it for 19 years with the Swamis of the Shivananda lineage and at Mumbai University. She is a panelist and teacher for Yoga Alliance continuing education programs. And as well as that, Mirabel has taught at yoga ashrams and studios throughout the world, in India, in the US, Canada, the Bahamas, Bermuda, and the Cayman Islands, where she lives currently. She is a guest teacher on international yoga teacher trainings on pranayama, on bhakti yoga, and on the deeper nuances of yoga as a living practice. Mirabel supports, in her work, committed yoga lovers to savor the luxury of inner experience and live purposefully, pleasurably, and joyfully through breath. She provides a loving space for them to unplug from urgency and into deep trust and allowing. Her signature offerings are Sadhana Club, which is an online sanctuary that brings grace, clarity, and community to yoga teachers and practitioners. And she also offers her Breathe Into a Radiant You private mentoring program for healing through breath. And we dive into all of this and more in this episode. There's just so much goodness and wisdom that Mirabel imparts for us all to listen to. And I learned so much just being in her presence, let alone getting to interview her. So with that, I would love to jump into this incredible conversation with Mirabel de Cunha.
In more ways than I can describe. But after that, it was also, you know, it's a very worldly thing to do, to organize a summit. Like it's not like Zen in the sense that it's not like you're in a class and you're teaching and you're tuning into energy. Yes, you're doing all of that, but there's all the admin and the practicalities and the egos of the speakers and, like, you know, all of those things. And they're all yoga teachers and practitioners, you know, like they. So after that, I really was asking myself if this is something I want to be or do. Like if yoga came, because, you know, as a teacher, it's a professional arena too, right? It's looked upon as a career. And right. And we do get caught up, and it's very hard not to get caught up in the trappings of, you know, marketing and promoting. And even though it may come with good intentions and a good heart, it still can be a trap. And so I asked myself, you know, would I drop being a yoga teacher if it came in the way of my practicing or having that relationship with yoga? And the truth is, yes, I drop it. I'm not ready to do it yet, but I would.
Wow. Yeah. And that's like such a testament to, you know, how deep and intimate your relationship with your practice is. I feel like to be able to know that you would, you know, drop it all if it meant, because if it got in the way of that, then everything you'd be teaching wouldn't matter, wouldn't be, you know, from your heart anyway. So part of the reason I'm so excited to have you on the show is because we both share the Shivananda Yoga, the practice of Shivananda Yoga. And it was my first introduction properly, like during my teacher training, is how I learned yoga, and it absolutely shifted everything for me, you know, blew my mind. And so I'm sure, you know, as you're a dedicated practitioner and teacher of Shivananda as well, you've probably felt many, many similar experiences. But I would love it just for anyone who's maybe unfamiliar, you know, obviously I've talked a little bit about it, especially on episode one of the podcast. But coming from your words, like if you would, it would just be so great to have you explain a little bit about this particular style of yoga, because it is quite particular, and you know, and your relationship with it.
Yeah, you know, firstly, I don't know if I'd call it a style of yoga, because I thought about this. This word is unfamiliar to me as an Indian, style of yoga. In our country, whether it's yoga, classical music, or classical dance, it's always, you know, the lineage or the gharana. So that's kind of the basis of your spiritual journey, or your, right, you know, whatever you're learning. It's the lineage, largely because it's an oral tradition for the most part, and also because the tradition is full of discernment. You don't give or you don't receive, depending on, you know, we're all teachers and students at the same time as we chant in that opening mantra, right? Sahana Bhavati.
Right.
till we're ready, you know, there has to be a readiness to be given. Sometimes we think we're ready, but we're not. Most of the time, at least myself, I'm so ready for this next level, next practice, next, you know, pearl of wisdom, but actually, no. My teachers mind me and put me in place, and I don't like it, but it's necessary. And so what I want to say is that it's a lineage because it carries with it thousands of years. You know, the lineage can be traced back. We have a lineage tree, and it can be traced back all the way to Adi Shankaracharya, like all the way back, like chronologically, you know, from guru to guru to guru, which is really incredible because, you know, it goes back a long time. So it tells you, one, about the efficacy of the practice. If it survived for so long, there must be something to it. And it's just, you know, like, yes, we can try like this sort of new age kind of yoga thing, right? Where for you know, it's a journey of exploration. So, you know, gurus be damned, did this happen? And I'm not criticizing any of those. You know, everybody, we all, including in our lineage, have these experiences, and we try to navigate them, but we can see ourselves clearly. Just like, you know, my daughter, who just turned 10, thinks she can figure it all out. But then I just let her for the most part, even though I can see, because if I tell her as a 10-year-old, she's just going to be like, Mom. So, but then eventually she comes and asks for guidance, because she discovers, either by experience or by her own little wisdom, that I need guidance. And so that to me is the beauty of the lineage, that the path has been walked before. I don't need to reinvent it. I have enough going on in my life, as I'm sure everybody else does, to figure out that I don't want to sit and figure this out. And in the past, when I've been arrogant enough, and I have been, to think that I can figure it out, I've just reached like dead ends, you know, and then kind of crashed. So just to put that lineage into the context. And then what I love about Shivananda Yoga is so many things, you know, when I just look at Swami Shivananda, and if you're listening to this podcast, please go and read about him, because there's almost no, you know, lineage or like even style that has not been influenced by him in some way or the other. He was like this massive giant, physically as well, and, you know, metaphorically as well, that really changed the face of sort of modern day yoga. And, you know, he was a medical doctor, and then he, long story, he found a calling and got initiated by his guru, and then served so much. He served, like, that's what he did his whole life. He wrote over 400 books. He wrote personal letter replies to like everyone that like wrote him letters. And he set up dispensaries and clinics in addition to, like, you know, the yoga work and the yoga centers. And he also initiated, what I really like and is captivating to me about him, is that he initiated the first woman into sannyas. So for those of you that are not familiar, sannyas is taking the vows of becoming a yogic monk, right? A monk, and could be yogic or another way. And women were not allowed in those days. And we can go into reasons why. It's not about sexism at all, really, though it did get distorted into that. And so he initiated the first woman. She was a German woman that saw him in a vision and knew she had to go to India, and initiated her into sannyas and got a lot of flack for it, but he did it. Wow. And she has a beautiful autobiography. There are very few books written by women, or even gurus, you know, even in our lineage, there are very few female swamis, and often I find, if I'm truthful, that I find that they're a bit subservient to the male swamis. I don't know if it's my projection or if it is so, but so this woman, Swami Shivananda Radha, wrote an autobiography, and it's called Radha, Diary of a Woman's Search.
And okay, it's
exquisite, because she's a German ballerina that visited India because she got called in this vision and could obviously do every asana really well, was the only woman in the asana class. You know, I mean, everything she writes about, it really resonates with me. I go back to her book many times because I find it very practical and honest and inspiring. And then what I love also about Shivananda Yoga is that it's very practical. You know, even Swami Vishnu, when he set up all these centers in the West, even though there were things, you know, there are accusations against him, and who knows about it, you know, who knows, I wasn't there. I'm not playing this side or the other, but when I ask, how important is it to me in my sadhana, whether this happened or didn't happen? Not really. Because I don't want anything to distract me from my practice, right? But what he said was the purpose of yoga teacher training was to transform inside, and then we can be at peace with the world no matter how it is. Not to say that we won't have turbulence, but we will still have the tools to come back home to peace. And that is what I find so powerful about this lineage, that it's not looking to convert people to this lineage or to this style, or, you know, it's not looking to please people and why they're coming to yoga and how it can fit into what they want. it's very clear. This is practical. This is about you, and not everybody's ready for it. And no problem if you aren't. But here's this beautiful practice in the way that you live it and the way the asana sequences. It's just amazing because on so many levels, it's just with not just with the physical and the endocrine function and what it does to the fascia, all things that science is now starting to talk about, health and fitness are now starting to talk about from a limited perspective still, you know, and just the way to integrate it into our entire way of living, it's exquisite. It takes courage to embrace a path like that, because it's not like, oh, you know, it's a buffet and I'm hungry and I'll see what I want today. And, you know, maybe I'll eat this today and not tomorrow. There's no space for that, because what are we really committing to?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not the style or the lineage. We're actually committing to ourselves. So if we don't commit to the sadhana and to the lineage, actually the lineage loses nothing. I lose because I don't commit to myself. I don't commit to trust. And if I can't trust, then I have to ask why.
Incredible. Yeah, I'm just nodding in agreement to everything, because it's so for those who don't know, this lineage of yoga teaches a set series of postures to practice and perfect, or, you know, maybe not perfect, but yeah. and that's the practice. You do the same kind of sequence each time. And when I first learned that, you know, I was like, oh, really? Like, you know, my way of thinking, like, oh, I want to be free. I want to choose all that, like, you know, but that's exactly what you said. Like, what the practice actually does in this, you know, there's so many intricacies to it, but in that way of it being like, it's a discipline. You do your sadhana, you do your practice, and through it being the set sequence each time, you don't lose any, like, you learn so much about yourself. You find, like, something I found with, like, the trauma-informed aspect as well, is like knowing what's coming next is actually very helpful for the nervous system and for, you know, just allowing the practice to really work its magic. So yeah, I think that's incredible. Everyone needs to try Shivananda yoga.
Yeah,
my opinion.
Yeah, and I used to think that it would be boring too, because I was very vata and you know, very like yeah. And but I'm amazed at how many years I've been practicing the same sequence, and I won't say I'm never bored. I have moments of like plateaus and kind of like, you know, like I need a little bit of a switch or a break, just a little here and there, but it's never lasts long. I always want to come back home, you know? And yeah, you know, that's what you said about trauma-informed and having set sequence. And I just want to say, you know, if you're used to a set sequence from another style, for example, say Ashtanga yoga, this is really different, because the emphasis is not on the physical, even though it is physically challenging in the beginning. The emphasis is on letting go of the physical challenge, letting go of the strife and the struggle through really developing a relationship with ourselves through prana shakti, through breath. Or rather, prana is not breath, the energy that is within breath, but we start with breath, right? So the flow is about the breath, about synchronizing the breath with the body. It's about rhythm. It's about intimacy. And all of us know, even with, you know, our regular intimacy in our grihastha life, like, we try different things, but there's something that you kind of go back to that sort of works, you know? And that's the beauty of the design, that it when we do the same thing over and over again with awareness and with surrender, then wisdom arrives. It's not about how many asanas I know, how flexible I am, though, of course, that's also part of the journey. You know, we can't like bypass any steps, you know. but it's something else. It's those things start to drop. And the spaciousness and the energy of deep connection and of presence, of realizing, of noticing our own patterns, the patterns of our mind. We can watch them so much more when we're not focusing on the physical. Because if I'm trying to watch a teacher and catch up with what she or he is doing, I can't really focus on what's happening inside my body. What is my mind doing in this asana? Is it retaliating? Does it always do this? What would it like to be more comfortable? What happens when I share breath with the discomfort? There's just so much. There's the physical, and in the physical, there are stages. There's the pranic, there's the introspection of the svadhyayi parichasan, there's the what it does to the endocrine system. It's a whole universe. Why is the sequence the way it is? What does it have to do with, you know, the chakras? And let's leave the chakras out, this highly abused word, right? What does it have to do with the process of creation and dissolution? And what is my birth and death in each practice and in each shavasana, which is what intersperses, which is the pause between each asana? There's always a shavasana. Why? It's not random.
Very deliberate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so you see true. What we have, sorry. Yeah,
no,
where we have like a separate practice now, there's a you know, restorative yoga, and there's a Ashtanga yoga or a heart yoga. And so there's like this complete like attack the practice, and then completely it's all there in Shivananda. You don't need to go to separate practices. You know, there's yoga nidra. We have beautiful dissolution kind of nidra. It's not the same as nidra, but, you know, at the end of the practice, we have a shavasana between each asana. We have pranayama in the practice to prepare ourselves for the asana, and then we have it through noticing the movement of breath in the asana. We have mantras. It's all there in one complete meal. So there, if it feels like home for you, then there's no more searching. Unless, of course, by grace, sometimes we have to go on another path sometimes, you know, it happens.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. Like, for me, it felt like home, even though obviously it's not my culture or my, you know, anything to do with me. In some way, it is for my soul. So, yeah, that was it for me. So, I love how you mentioned, well, there's so many things I want to talk to you about, but you mentioned that there is this intimacy with the breath and, you know, with prana through the breath. And I know this is something that you love to teach about. And so, you know, it's just not something that many people consider, you know. Even most of the time, a lot of us aren't even aware of our breath at all, you know. So, I think it's so needed, first of all, and such a beautiful way of teaching about the breath. So I would love to hear, yeah, you know, your take on what that means, intimacy with your breath.
Yeah, it's not actually my take at all. I wrote to one of my teachers, Swami Shambhudevananda, and I was in his class in the Bahamas Ashram a couple of years ago. And he was an advanced teacher training, and he said, I can't remember the words, but he was saying all these things, and it was like the way he was articulating it, it almost sounded like he was making love to the breath, or the breath was making love to him. And I literally had to, like, because he was like, and feel it caressing the inner walls of your nostrils. And I like actually had to open my eyes to be like,
wait,
this is funny. am I hallucinating a thing? But I wasn't. His eyes were closed and he was completely like transmitting this experience. And he used the word, get intimate with your breath. Something happened to me physiologically, energetically at that time. And I've never been the same. And I never will be the same because of that. And I had a whole personal journey with all of this. And I asked him if I could share this, you know, and he's so sweet. He said, I don't own anything. You know, you feel free. You have my blessings. And so that's how I actually have a course on my online school called Intimacy with Breath. It's a 9-day journey. Actually, it was launched last year during Navratri, which is where we are right now.
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So it came to me. It came to me first through him and then through my own exploration. I kind of feel like the Divine Mother gave me these 9 nights because I didn't plan to teach it or do it in this way. It just kind of came, and then that's what I shared, and those are the recordings, the 20-minute recordings of mine, 9 ways to notice our experience and relationship with breath. And you know, when you ask me about myself or like my what is unique, I you know, feel about the way that this practice or the transmission of this practice comes to me is that it's and this is what my students say, or those students say, that it's they receive like an experience. The word is anubhava in English, you know, in Sanskrit, anubhava. And that word means you kind of have like a somatic experience, like there's no need for the theory. There's no need for any of those things. Not to say that they're not important or that I don't study or teach them, okay? Everything has its place. But if we focus so much on lengthening the breath, deepening the breath, slowing the breath, you know, it becomes a matter of performance. Almost like, you know, breath or pranayama in yoga is like some kind of performance or some kind of a feat we're trying to perform. And it's not. You know, there are people that never did any pranayama in their life and they're so advanced, you know, spiritually, like they're so humble. Right. That's what I mean by advanced. They're just so connected and compassionate and humble. So what are we getting stuck with when we go on? Like even myself, like, you know, in Shivananda, we practice basically just anulom vilom. And that's what I've been doing since I was 16. I'm 40 now. And it's given me so much, right? I've done, you know, sadhana intensive and advanced training, but those are not practices we're meant to practice outside of the ashram. And there's good reason for that. And the thing is that there's often a need or a desire, which is perhaps maybe more Western, could also be Indian, but you know, I noticed it at least when I came to the West. You go to buy bread in India, there are maybe 3, well, at least in the past, there were 3 or 4 types of bread you could buy. I remember going into a supermarket in New York when I first arrived in the States, and I just wanted bread. And they were like, there was a whole aisle almost of bread. And I almost had a headache because there was so much to read in terms of what was in them. And then the prices and like just expiry dates and like everything, it was just too much. And it just cluttered my mind. And I thought, this is just crazy. And then you live long enough and then you become like, you know, what kind of bread am I going to have? Because the culture grows, it just kind of inundates you. And so, you know, we have to ask ourselves, what is it that I'm trying to do by getting more practices or more types of practice? What void am I trying to fill to think that one practice is not enough? Or that I need to get upgraded? Like I need to feel if I'm doing advanced practices, I'm more spiritually advanced. Mm-hmm. You know, or I've worked harder, or like, what is the story we're telling ourselves? And it's really hard to do this. Hey? Like, I have my teacher to like, you know, snap me out of my own like illusions, which are many. So, you know, this is something to, just that intimacy is, when we're deeply intimate, we don't care. We don't think about our things. We don't judge. We don't prove. We just are immersed in that connection and that experience. And that's what I feel called currently for the last couple of years, at least. Who knows what comes tomorrow, to share. Yeah.
I love that. And yeah, I can definitely see the correlation between like, you know, focusing so much on the physical, even if it's focusing on breathing more, like feeling your body more with breath, you know, being, you know, like a pillar of Western civilization in a way, like focusing on the physical, the making you freeze because there's so much choice that you don't know what to do. Like, I feel like that's such a, especially in the state, especially in the US, there's like even more choice than anywhere, I feel like.
Yeah, I understand it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so yeah, you just bringing it back to like ease and not struggling and not striving for anything, just simply being instead of doing, which is another, you know, prized thing in the West.
Yeah. I mean, we have to do in the beginning, like that's the discipline, building that discipline. And I think that the being is arises from the doing, but what are we doing? Mm-hmm. So, you know, having so many different practices and it's already a state of rajas, right? Of restlessness in the world. It has been for a long time and it's not going to reduce. And then when we're adding more of these like complications to our sadhana, we're just escalating the rajas. Who is going to not benefit from this? Me. Nobody else cares. Because the yoga industry, and it is an industry, just wants to sell a different types of things, you know? Like, for example, I have just one main offering. It's called Sadhana Club. And it's just about, it's like very kind of traditional in a way where you come and you join, you know, and then we journey together exploring like practical aspects of sadhana, from everything to do with like our relationship with money, because hey, spiritual people don't want to discuss that. We have lots of traumas and hidden like subconscious, unconscious behaviors around that. And we just hide sometimes in love and light, or oh, but I'm doing good, so it's okay that, you know, I'm serving. And like, I've done all this myself, so I'm speaking from like mocking my own past self, okay? I have to watch out for it. And you know, so what about those things? Like, it's not just about scriptures, and I don't teach scriptures because, you know what, like knowing the level of people that are in my country, including my own teachers, like I wouldn't dare have the audacity to teach scripture. But what I can teach and share more than teach is sadhana. And, you know, bringing that commitment to ourselves, it's not something that is being forced upon us, you know? Discipline is not a forced thing. It is strict, but I think of it as firm love, not permissive love. You know, if a mother raises her child with like, oh, do whatever you want, the child has no, it has no anchor.
Mm-hmm. No boundaries.
No boundaries. And boundaries are necessary, especially for us doing this work, right? Definitely. Because we generally are not very good with boundaries for the most of us. And so therefore having the sadhana is firm love. It's setting boundaries. You know, it's okay, here you can be creative, but here is a canvas and the canvas ends here. Now do what you can with it. The, you know, these are some options. Pick something. You can't start painting something and switch to something else on the same canvas. And, you know, you can, but it just brings more strife into one's life. So just, and then that's where the diet and the dosha balancing and all the Ayurveda, which is missing in, you know, it's like almost like a separate thing, but it's not. Right. Like, Ayurveda go together. If I keep regular timings for eating, regular timings for sleeping, which is not easy by any stretch, but it must be done. Then the mind is more settled when you do sadhana. Then the perception is more clear. I could read all the philosophy in the world and attend classes with the best teachers in the world. But if I don't take care of my physical body, because that's my home in this lifetime, well, that's useless, you know. It's really just like data floating around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm in complete agreement. I actually recently saved a quote from Natalia Benson, someone I'm learning about money from at the moment, actually, says, discipline allows for our greatness to be expressed. And that's my saved on my phone to remind me, because, yeah, that was something, you know, like, me, I'm very Vata, you could probably tell instantly. I was very dissociated for a lot of my life, very like lost. And then finding this anchor, it is an anchor of the practice. And when I learned all about, not all about, but when I had my introduction to Ayurveda and learning about balancing your whole being, mind, body, spirit, it just changed everything for me. And yeah, I'm just grateful that you mentioned this, because it's something that I think, yeah, often now it's shied away from, like, no, you can be completely free and, you know, do whatever feels good. And that's great in a way, but I think that, yeah, we need that structure of the discipline of the practice as well to make it safe enough to express in our own ways. Yeah. In total agreement.
Discipline is freedom.
I love that. It's so true. Well, I feel like we could talk about that for hours too, but I know you mentioned also, and something I would love to hear more about from you is, I actually didn't realize you were the organizer of the, I attended some of it, the Pranayama Summit. Yeah, if you could speak to that. It was the first one in the world, which is incredible. You know, what kind of experience was that like, organizing as well as participating?
Yeah, it was the second summit that I organized. The last one was last year, again, by Inner Guidance.
Oh, I'm so sorry for mixing up.
The pandemic. The first one was a Bhakti Yoga Summit. Because, you know, bhakti is the practice for Kali Yoga, which is where we are now. And with COVID had just started, and this was just the guidance. And I was like, literally in meditation, like, how am I going to organize this? I have no idea how to organize a summit. I've never done it before. And it was like, you just have to do it. And then I actually was like, you have to give me a sign. I'll do it, Ma, like Divine Mother. Like, you need to like give me a sign in the physical world, because I'm really doubting this, like, for real. And then I had a sign, and like instantly, literally right after meditation, and that's sort of how it went. And, you know, with the Bhakti Summit, it's really about the core of Bhakti as a practice, because, again, there's so much distortion with the westernization of, like, making it a commodity, you know? What is bhakti? What is surrender? And just all of that. So I had, you know, feminist perspectives on bhakti, because those exist in India. We won't see that in the West. You don't see that. It's just like a few mantras being sung to different tunes. And for the large part, like, it's kind of like a bit like pop music kind of thing, you know? So yeah, we, you know, explored all of these beautiful and wonderful aspects of bhakti yoga, which is not just kirtan, like all of bhakti yoga, and you know what it has to do with neurobiology and just all of these like fascinating speakers that some of whom I knew from before because of, you know, being sort of in this for a while, and you know, others that were new but, you know, really fantastic. So yeah, that's available still for anyone that wants to, you know, avail of it. And then the Pranayama Summit came this year again as an inner guidance, and I had sworn to myself after the last summit I wasn't going to do another one. But you know, if you get the call, you just have to answer. So what we explored in the summit was pranayama, how to even say the word correctly, because it's not been pronounced correctly for the most part. And this whole thing around, like, you know, appropriating yogic practices and making it into breath work and this kind of breath work and that kind of. So, you know, not to discount, maybe, you know, some people maybe need it like that. I'm not, there's space for everything. But we did speak, you know, about what happens when you take a practice out of the system that's it's in. Because the system is not a trap. The system is the distillation of years of study and research, you know, like, and, you know, direct transmission. And the system is designed for efficiency. That's why we do the sadhana in the way that we're told to do it, because it, you know, if someone asks me that isn't really into yoga and say, what's yoga? I always say it's, you know, economy of effort and luxury of inner experience. That's how it comes to me to say it in like layman's terms, right? And if we just take a part about, just say, oh, let's just put people in ice buckets and then do breathing after, or, you know, whatever it is, fine. But know why you're going to the practice. Like, why are you doing yoga? You don't need to. Nobody will care. I'll tell you the truth. If I stop doing yoga today, nobody will care. Maybe my family a little bit. My daughter might even be a little happy because she thinks I'm too obsessed with it. Nobody will care. You know, a couple of people will ask and then they'll move on with their lives. So your yoga practice, my yoga practice, is not indispensable to the world. Our teaching is not indispensable to the world. So we have to keep asking, why am I doing this? Because yoga has specific goals. It has a specific experience or a beingness that it promises to take us to. And if I don't want that, it's fine. I can go and do ice bucket, whatever, you know. There's nothing wrong with that. But be clear, why are you practicing yoga? And if you're convinced about the system of yoga as, you know, a tool for whatever it is that your hunger is, then stick with it and have the whole meal, because otherwise it's just going to be like, you know, like they say in Shivananda, if you want to find water, dig deep in one place. If you dig in 10 places, you won't ever find it and you'll think there's something wrong with, you know, the place.
That's something my teacher would say, like, why go to a different well? Yeah. Well, I love that. And yeah, I think it's really now more than ever so necessary for us. You know, like, I don't know enough about the intricacies and the history of Pranayama and, you know, of the lineage, even just of Shivananda, or like, and there's so many lineages, like, I think it's very important to bring the, you know, the cultural and historical context to people who might just be trying it because they heard it was cool or heard it helps with stress, which is good. Like, you know, I feel like everyone needs it. The world needs yoga, but it's definitely been distorted. And that needs to change.
Yeah, and the distortion actually disadvantages us. You know, like when I tell my teacher in India, you know, this is what's happening in the West. You know, people are talking about post-lineage yoga and cultural appropriation and this, and it's like all these big debates happening around it. you know, he says, just leave it. Now we are practicing. Why should, like, why get involved in that? The real practitioners, right, they don't make a noise about it because they know it's not for everyone. Most people just want to, you know, yoga is a luxury lifestyle product. And that's what most people want. And it's okay. There's nothing wrong with it. But we don't need to convince them about why they should do things correctly. Or, you know, why they should. That's not our job. Our job is to do our practice and whoever's ready and willing, share it with them. Right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's, so the summit was really, I even wasn't sure how many people would sign up, but, you know, Deepak Chopra promoted it. He picked up on it, and then just like thousands of people, which is just really fantastic because we explored, you know, from the aspect of pranayama as devi sadhana. Like a lot of people, you know, there's so much masculinity in the practice of pranayama that the fact that it is actually a practice of the divine feminine is lost. Even I didn't know it till like, what, 6 years ago? Like, I wasn't told it, you know? Because it's like, few people know it, and then they'll only tell you if you're ready. Pranayama is actually practiced with mantra, not with counts. But that mantra, wow, you have to get initiated in. So wow, they won't give it to everybody. Not a single speaker on the summit wanted to talk about the mantra and pranayama because it's a secret thing.
Wow, I had no idea. Obviously, it's a secret.
Yeah. So, you know, not that I'm saying that it shouldn't be secret. There's a very good reason why it's only given to you when you're ready. And, you know, it's a very good reason for it. But, you know, there's just so many aspects. The myofascial aspects, you know, the physiology of the mouth, of the nose. This is not discussed. Like, I teach in a lot of teacher trainings. So, and I do teach pranayama, but you know, you get like 4 hours, 8 hours to teach the whole subject.
Mm-hmm.
I can't cover, like, I can barely cover anything. So actually this pranayama summit is like a massive teacher training. It's not even like a teacher. I would say it's like an introduction to a pranayama teacher training, even though there's 24 speakers. It's just an introduction, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's like just 2% of what might be there. I probably don't even know how much there is, right? So, yeah, these things need to be, you know, taken care of. We need to understand them. If someone has a deviated septum, how should they be practicing anulom vilom? If someone feels traumatized from retaining the breath, because lots of people do, because of trauma experiences, how do we, you know, assess that? How do we, you know, navigate that with the student? What are the things we need to do to keep the physical pathways clear for the nose and the sinuses? What's actually happening? What are the marma points? Like, you know, there are so many. What does prana look like? What is the energetic? What's the description of it? There's just so many things, like nobody talks about them, you know, like I don't understand why people are intrigued about it, but that's just me because I'm like obsessed with this, obviously.
Yeah, it's so intricate and and it's something that's automatic and no one pays attention to most of the time. Like, it's kind of insane when you think about it. So,
and
I think
COVID is all about the breath. If I look at in a divine sense, what is the pattern of COVID? COVID is like universal, right? It doesn't care what you look like, nothing, like what you have. And it's chosen. I'm like, why is it chosen to come as a respiratory disease? It could be anything else, right? It could attack your lungs or your heart or your lymph or like whatever, right? And what comes to me is that, firstly, if you see, you know, we, because of the way religion has been and everything, most people are fed up with religion. Most people are also fed up with yoga and all the allied, like, scandals and all of that hierarchy, patriarchy. And some people don't believe in God or don't care, or, you know, there's all kinds. But nobody can deny that we are alive because we are breathing. It's not like woo-woo, it's real. You literally can't live if you don't breathe. And if breath is life, then enjoying life, which we hopefully all of us want to do, is to breathe fully. Not how many places we've traveled, and all those are there, by the way, but 24/7, every single day, we are breathing. And COVID, to me, is either teaching us to be afraid of breath / life, or to get intimate with it.
Wow. That's such, yeah, that makes so much sense. And you can see the, you know, how so many people are struggling pre-COVID with life, you know, not enjoying it fully, not breathing fully also. I mean, obviously that's simplifying things majorly, but it's, yeah, the essence of, like, I see people, like, you know, when they really start to connect to their breath for the first time, maybe, or for the first time in a long time, it's a complete shift. And I'm sure you experience that every time too. Like, yeah, it's life changing. I mean, it is life. It's life changing when we connect to it. So I love that you brought this out into the world, the summit, I love that you're so passionate about sharing about it, because it is knowledge that not many people are aware of. Even if you've been doing yoga, practicing yoga, you know, for a long time. Yeah, it's amazing to hear. You're inspiring me to learn a lot more about pranayama and the breath and everything. Amazing. So I'm curious, because you mentioned, you know, when you teach and share breath and pranayama, you know, things that come up with trauma and responses to it. Is there, with your journey with the practice of yoga, is there things that you've been able to heal and shift, and that you, you know, see in other people in terms of, you know, big T or little T trauma, or just in your teachings as well? I'm just curious from your perspective, from the... Yeah.
I think pranayama is the ultimate trauma healing practice. What is trauma? It's blocked energy. Right?
Stuck,
it's,
yeah.
When we feel violated in some way, and we create or a blockage is created in us, which disconnects us from our true self.
Right.
Correct? So what does Nadi Shodhan pranayama do? It actually clears out the blockages in the nadis. Correct. So I don't need to sit there and say, today I'm going to work on this trauma, because you know what? Half the traumas I have, I didn't even know I had them.
Right.
Right. That's the, and I work one-on-one. I do a program called Breathe Into a Radiant You. It's a 9-week one-on-one, thing that, again, I was guided to. And the first session, people always say it feels like dying. Like, it's awful. The first session is awful. You know, it's a terrible sales pitch, but it's really awful. Everybody says, oh my God, the word here locally is like, if you're signing up for it, because people tell their friends, and they're like, make sure you take the rest of the day off, because you want to go home and sleep, or like just cry, or, you know. But that's what, and it's all through pranayama. Like, all of this stuff in the Breathe Into a Radiant You program is all pranayama. And it heals traumas. And not that it all ends in 9 sessions. Some people don't need to come back after 9, and some people need to. So, you know, that's not something that I always say. I can't, there are no guarantees here, because even I don't know what's going to happen. I just connect and I'm guided. And then, you know, if you sit with the toolbox of this is how we're going to hack at the trauma, we may be close to what wants to come through grace. Right? Because why do I need this toolbox? Why do I need to set exactly what's going to happen in a session? If I really ask, it's actually because of my insecurity of seeming or feeling inadequate. But when we do regular sadhana, in, you know, and this is like just a very broad statement because there's just a lot to be said about regular sadhana and the spirit in which we do it and, you know, who we learn it from, etc., etc. We develop this connection with pranashakti. And it is a kind of a self-confidence, but it's not arrogant. It's like, it's just a comfort, but it's not complacent. I don't know how to explain it.
And it's like connecting to your true self.
I don't know if it's my true self. I don't think I have access to her yet. But definitely to the divine energy of the divine mother for me, you know. And so what it does is it chips away. Sometimes it chips away, sometimes it dissolves, sometimes it explodes through these blockages in the nadis, right? And that's where the trauma healing happens. So there are ways to do it with psychology, with shadow work, with inner child work, all of which are wonderful. But the pranayama naturally breaks down the resistance because I'm not telling you a story. You're not telling me a story. We're not getting stuck in, but I felt like this and this and, you know, like chronology, all of these things. They just kind of, I'm not saying they're not important, but in these particular sessions, like I don't find them relevant because I'm always, when we start going through the session and the talking part begins, I always say, it's not about the story. Like, come back to how you feel. How are you feeling in your body? I was feeling suffocated, or I was feeling like, you know, they didn't want me, or, you know, whatever it is that's coming up for a person. And we have to go through our pain. We can't bypass the pain. And a lot of us bypass, myself included, you know, bypass the pain with the story. Because the story is drama, and drama is exciting for the registered mind. And, you know, it makes for great copy for, you know, writing an article or a podcast or, you know, or Instagram. It makes for great copy. It really does.
It's but, true, you know, yeah.
At the end of the day, I'm sharing something here, and that's also, there's also a story to it. But it has to drop when I go to my practice. I'm sharing it here because it will be relevant and help someone else connect. Outside of it, it has no relevance. Why would anyone care what happens in my life? Irrelevant, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, again, the focus, like, on retelling or like on the events, which it does, you know, it is important to acknowledge instead of just completely pretending something didn't happen, for example. But yeah, that's something that I've discovered in my own healing and see with others, is like by committing to these body-based practices, like, it does it for you. There's, like you said, there's no need to use words. Like, it's just releasing, yeah, as it happens, yeah, like as it comes.
That we don't need an agenda. And I'll say one last thing, you know, even asana practice, when it's taught, like this whole emphasis on anatomy, it's not there in India. Why? Because the emphasis on marma points. We activate, like if we're doing, sarvangasana, shoulder stand, right? We're activating a marma point here. It also activates these endocrine glands. And there are marmas, like there's, you know, a marma on top of the eyebrow to release anger. So everything that we do in asana, if you, in a lineage-based practice like Shivananda, right, has to do with clearing the blockages in the marmas. Are like, they're not chakras, but they're like little intersections of, you know, of nadis. They're not like powerful, very powerful ones, but they're important. Mm-hmm. So the whole asana practice is a pranayama practice, and practice of releasing prana. So I've just begun crying, and I've had it with students sometimes. You know, you just start crying during an asana because you're holding it for, we're not holding it, we're just kind of being with it, you know, holding it as a bit. I don't know. We're just kind of giving ourselves up to it, perhaps, for, you know, an extended period of time, like 2 minutes, 3 minutes, and they'll just start crying suddenly because, why? And they say, I don't know why I was crying, and I don't know if I should come back, and I'm so sorry I disturbed the class. And I'm like, no, this is the point of asana, to unblock the marmari, to unblock the prana. If it's not doing that, if your practice makes you feel high all the time, there's something wrong with it. No, there really is.
Right. You know? Because we're here, we need to ground. Yeah. I mean, from about a week in, my whole Shivananda teacher training was me sobbing every time we practice and still sometimes. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's such an important point. And the mama points, for anyone who isn't aware, Google it. because we'll have to wrap things up here in a second. But Mirabelle, I would love to just ask one final question for you that I love to ask every guest who comes on is, right now, currently, long-term, but what moves you, or what's your favorite way to move your energy, or what happens to move your energy on lately? Or move your heart, or ways that you like to move your body?
To move my body, I like walking meditation. I like five rhythms dancing. I like asana, of course.
Of course.
it's more relative. Yeah.
Amazing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's, like I said, it's really an honor, and it's so great to talk about all the stuff we've talked about, Shivananda yoga and having your wisdom imparted to everyone here. It's it's so beautiful. So thank you so much, and I hope we stay in touch and learn more and more about the intimacy of the breath.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. And your energy is just so innocent and fresh and beautiful and childlike. And I mean that in the most beautiful way.
Thank you.
Yeah, here's to committing to ourselves and asking every day, why am I doing this?
I love that. Yes.
Thank you.
It's simple. Keep it simple. That should be the rule. Well, thank you, Mirabelle, so much. I'll
thank
say goodbye.
You.
Have a beautiful rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Namah Shivaya. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, I would love it if you could leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you heard this. To stay connected with me, head to bemovedyoga.com and sign up for my email list. I'm also bemovedyoga on Instagram. Catch up with you soon. Lots of love from Louise.